please call to order the meeting of the House Committee on Environment and Land Use. It is 8:35 on February 25th, and we will be following our agenda as published. So we are first this morning going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2431. Mr. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2431 allows a person seeking a permit to remove material from or fill waters of the state to pay money into the Oregon Wetlands Mitigation Fund account instead of obtaining a permit. It specifies the replacement ratio for wetlands loss. It specifies that the Director or Division of State Lands has the burden to prove that wetlands exist on property for which the permit is sought, and allows a person to seek a writ of mandamus to force the Division of State Lands to make a final decision on permit application after 90 days. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the advantage of committee members, I've gone ahead and gone over the background of how we got to where we are with the removal of fill laws, and I'll go over that with the chair's permission.
Please do.
Under the Clean Water Act, which is 86 Statute 817, is amended 33 U.S.C. United States Code, Chapter 1251 and following, Congress provided the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency with oversight and regulatory enforcement authority over the waters of the United States, including territorial areas. Clean Water Act provisions also provide for the EPA to delegate authority for many permitting, administrative, and enforcement aspects of the law to state governments. Section 404G of the Clean Water Act governs removal, fill, permitting in navigable and non-navigable waters. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers administers the removal, fill portion of the Clean Water Act. House Bill 2785 in 1995 authorized the Division of State Lands to seek delegated authority to assume Section 404G regulatory programs. However, the legislature directed the Division to not apply the fill removal provisions of Oregon law when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers requires any individual permit if Oregon had not received approval or notification of approval from the Environmental Protection Agency. In response to implementation issues related to House Bill 2785 from 1995, Senate Bill 207 from 1997 was introduced and passed into law. Senate Bill 207 was developed to enable the Division to pursue internal and external streamlining options designed to deliver improved processes in order to address program assumption concerns at the federal, state, and local levels. Senate Bill 207 directed the Division to use existing authority and administrative tools to reduce paperwork, eliminate duplication, increase certainty and timeliness, and enhance resource protection. The legislative measure also eliminated the June 30th, 1997 assumption date and required the Division to report to the 70th Legislative Assembly as to the success of streamlining efforts. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Committee, we have received a fax from a Robin Hartman with the Oregon Shores Conservation Coalition that will be made part of the public record. Does the committee members have a copy of that fax?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, you do. Thank you.
Not everybody.
Okay. We have nine people who have signed up to speak this morning. Four individuals for the bill, four individuals against the bill, and one that's neutral on the bill. So I can't get any fairer than that. And also, the first thing we're going to do is take the people who have traveled the furthest. So, Jay Lorenz. Good morning, Mr. Lawrence.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you for putting me at the head of the line. I appreciate that. My name is, for the record, my name is Jay Lorenz. I'm manager of natural resources at Terra Associates, 12525 Willows Road in Kirkland, Washington, 98034. Prior to moving to Washington, I owned and operated a wetland consulting business here in Oregon for 10 years. I still maintain a group of clients in Oregon. The scope of my practice, the geographic scope of my practice, ranges from the southern Oregon coast, Brookings, and all around the Willamette Valley. So with that quick background, I'm here today in support of House Bill 2431, and some of the reasons that I'm for it, I think that if we look at Oregon's land use laws that go back to the 1970s, there's been an inherent conflict between trying to group our growth inside urban growth boundaries and still protect all of the natural resources that lay within those boundaries. There's an inherent conflict between trying to manage growth and protect resources at the same time, and I think some of that issue has led us to where we are today. I think that this bill places greater emphasis on planning. It has takes a very proactive approach to the planning process, would require DSL to work more closely, the Division of State Lands to work more closely with Goal 5 resources and in the administration of Goal 5 resources. It would require cities and towns to, as I understand it, to identify high-quality wetlands and what wetlands maybe had lower functional values. So it would be beneficial to planners, developers, and everyone when it came up to time to permitting. The bill places greater emphasis on functions and values of wetlands and links the mitigation to replacing lost functions and values. We have lots of wetlands that are of marginal value. They just barely meet the criteria for qualifying as a jurisdictional wetland, yet our mitigation process is based on an area ratios, and the way that the rules are actually administered, our rules are administered on mitigation being based on area ratios rather than replacement of functional values. And I think one of the things that this bill does is puts greater emphasis on the functional values. It also places greater emphasis on wetland mitigation banking. And right now we conduct many, and I'm part of it, we're required to do essentially postage stamp wetland mitigation banks. A lot of times our on-site mitigations are inside urban growth boundaries. They're surrounded by housing and development. It meets the intent of the law, but ecologically what we're producing has questionable value. I think that there are some places that are subject to debate in the bill. In discussions with some of my esteemed colleagues and friends in the room here today that you'll be hearing, there's a figure of $20,000 in the bill for a fee for wetland mitigation banking. There's some language about mitigation ratios at 1-to-1. I think some of these issues are worthy of some good discussion and debate, but I don't think that the bill ought to be thrown out because of some of these details. I know my colleague Phil Scholes, who will be testifying after me or sometime after me, has some ideas to address some issues that I think may be of concern to many people. And I guess without stealing Phil's thunder, I do want to express my support for the amendments that Mr. Scholes will be presenting to the committee. I think I'll keep my comments pretty short here and just again just reemphasize this. The emphasis on mitigation banking really has mitigation banking and using that as a stronger tool in wetland mitigation just has tremendous amount of potential that's not being used today. Mitigation banks can be large areas. They're overseen with much greater detail than the normal wetland mitigation and a standard mitigation permit. There's oversight, but on a small scale, and there's very little monitoring of our mitigation sites. Mitigation banks are large areas that can be provide significant areas for wildlife, for wetland rehabilitation and restoration, and restore wetland functions on a very large scale. And to what I really like about the legislation, the intent and the concept in this legislation, is that it really is trying to find that balance between allowing some of our especially marginal wetlands to be impacted within our urban growth boundaries and finding a really good way to mitigate for those lost functions and values that can produce valuable and productive ecological units. So I like the concepts of the bill, and I hope that some of the details can be worked out and as this goes through the process here. Thank you.
Any questions of Mr. Lorenz?
Hey,
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lorenz, if you were drafting this bill, what provisions would you include that are not included in it?
What would I include in it that's not in it? I don't know that there's anything in it that I would add. I think that there may be some things that might change. For example, I think Mr. Scholes is going to present an amendment on the $20,000 fee. I think that on the mitigation banking, I think that that option ought to be available. Instead of $20,000, we might come up with a different fee structure. And I'll let Mr. Scholes present his amendment. There's still concern. There's a concern in the bill about there's a one-to-one mitigation ratio, maximizing mitigation at a one-to-one ratio. And I think that what I would suggest perhaps is that be the land area be taken out, and that we emphasize mitigation based on functions and values, and not get stuck and hung up on an area to area ratio. And so I think that would be one place where I don't have a specific amendment to offer, but I don't want to get hung up on the area. And I think that's one of the problems that we have now. We don't want to get hung up on an area based mitigation ratios. We want to emphasize the function replacement of lost functions and values.
May I follow?
Panel.
How do you determine that? Who makes that decision? Is that done by an appraiser, by a committee?
We were just having a discussion about that earlier this morning. The scientific community has established, has tried to establish a number of different methods for rating functions and values. And I think that a way that could be done in this state would be to, it may require a panel of scientists, consultants, people from agencies, so it may require a panel of scientists to help establish that, because there are lots of different methods and approaches that scientists have already kind of developed and tried, and I think probably a committee of scientists might be the appropriate way to take that scientific knowledge and put something together that would be applicable and useful in the regulatory context of Oregon's laws.
Thank you.
Representative Greenwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, sir. I'm a freshman, so if I could ask a question that might help educate me on this issue, since you're a wetland consultant and I know to call on consultants. Maybe you would just tell me what a wetland is and why, as a matter of social policy, we protect wetlands.
Boy, whole university courses are taught on that subject.
I'll try and enroll in just a minute.
You have 30 seconds.
30 seconds, yeah. Thank you. You know, I studied under Dr. Frankel, who's also in the audience here. You know, all of my friends are here. The short answer to what is a wetland is wetlands are areas that have hydric soil, have wetland hydrology, and wetland vegetation, so that there are three legs to the wetland stool. And so there's a formal definition. It's based on the water. If you have water, if soils are saturated or inundated near the surface during the growing season, it will create wetland soils, hydric anaerobic conditions of in the soils, and then there are plants that are adapted to being able to grow under anaerobic conditions. Most soils in non-wetland environments are aerobic. They have oxygen in the soil, and a different type of plant can grow in them. The wet sites, why wetlands are valuable to society is that they perform lots of services that are beneficial to us. Everything from biofiltration, filtering pollutants out of runoff and water. They provide areas, breeding grounds for fish, and they're quite often the source of our clean water in our streams and rivers. So that's my 30-second answer.
Great. Can I follow up on that, sir?
Follow-up representative question.
And if they serve these social functions as sort of natural filters for our water supply, and I think there's probably something about migratory birds and some other things that are involved in it, and you said the problem is that there are marginal wetlands that aren't really important. I understand that. But I wonder, given what you just said about social value, if you really support Section 2, Part 1, Line 10 through 15, that would simply allow somebody to take any wetland out by simply paying 75% of its value into a fund without regard to a permit process or anything? Is that?
Yeah, I don't have the bill and those specific lines in front of me, but
I'd be happy to read it. It simply says, yeah, provide an applicant a permit option to pay into the Wetlands Mitigation Bank Revolving Fund account established, etc., an amount of money equal to 75% of the assessed value of the property for which a permit is. So, and that relieves the applicant from any obligation to provide a compensatory wetland or anything else.
Yeah, okay.
And I was just wondering whether you're here testifying in favor of that particular section.
Well, I think in the context of this, if that were just the bill, I'd have to say no, I'm not strictly in favor of that. If that was the process, I would support a process where there was planning done as part of our Goal 5 planning, especially in our urban areas, where we were identified the high value wetlands and the wetlands that were so that when we came to this section of paying into a revolving fund, I don't think that paying into a revolving fund should be taken out of context of planning and identifying stream corridors, high-value wetlands that should be protected so that anybody could just go in and pay a fee to impact wetlands independent of any kind of evaluation. So the any fees that should be paid, there needs to be an evaluation process. And I would especially like to see a proactive approach in the evaluation of our wetlands right now the permitting process is a reactive one, and so we're, and it tends to be produce a piecemeal kind of process. So just as long as this section was done in the context of wetland conservation planning and very strict evaluation of your wetland resources in a jurisdiction, so that you could evaluate what was, and you had agreements ahead of time with the, so that there were kind of pre-agreements with between DSL and the local community as to what was going to be valuable and what needed to be saved and what was of less value, then this that process might work.
I just follow up on that. So that process standing alone, if we just put in law a process that anybody who wants to develop a wetland doesn't have to get a permit but just pays into a fund without any planning or anything else, that you would oppose that, I think.
Yes, I would.
Thank you.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Lorenz, what's the difference between a wetlands and a swamp?
For many years, a swamp is a wetland. Wetlands come in all different sizes, shapes, and forms. So people, there are all kinds of classifications. Swamps, bogs, are we have wet prairies. There are all kinds of wetlands, and swamps are just one of many types of wetlands.
Before we're done, I'm trying to get an idea of one, it's a very basic thing, and is why is this such an important issue? And I'm not real clear on the vitality and importance of designating any time you have, I think you said hydrated soil?
Hydrology.
Saturated soils require protection, and that, I'm not sure why that's the case. Why, if you have a part of your property that has sitting water, automatically it requires special conditions, $20,000 to buy your way out of it, and God forbid that you might put dirt on it. And so maybe before we're done today, as we hear testimony, we'll get a feel for, you know, why it is so important to do this. And is there a threshold where this could qualify as a wetlands but is so small and de minimis it's not worth the hassle and the punitive nature of restriction as compared to it's large enough that it does require that? And so I'm just kind of mentioning that for everyone who's going to testify, that I'd like to get that kind of an answer.
Those are very good questions, and I think that's one of the things that has frustrated people in doing development inside our urban growth boundaries. That we do the wetland rules state that the wetland hydrology criteria is satisfied if soils are saturated for a minimum of basically 2 weeks during the growing season. And the growing season is taken to start roughly March 1st in Western Oregon. So you could have soils that are saturated near the surface for through March 15th and have an area called a wetland. And that essentially gets the same amount of protection as a swamp that may have inundation, be perennially inundated, or have saturated, so perennially saturated soils. So I think that that's part of the issue that we're trying to get at and address, I think, in refining our wetland legislation. I don't know whether that helps answer the question a little bit.
Well, it does, because it clarifies something. I didn't realize that 2 weeks' worth of sitting water justifies or requires the same protection as, you know, a year-round migratory bird location, you know, landing zone. And so it is a little scary, because if I had a piece of land that had water sitting on it for 2 weeks and all of a sudden it was deemed a wetlands, I'd feel pretty imposed upon by the government with all the regulations that would be there. So hopefully we'll learn a little bit more about it as time goes on. Thank you very much.
Yeah, if I could add one thing in, I think that's where when we talk about mitigating on a function and value basis, the wetland that is only saturated for, say, 2 weeks of the year or 3 or 4 weeks of the year, in terms of the amount of biofiltration that it provides, the amount of groundwater recharge that it provides, the amount of water that it's contributing to streams is far, far less. The amount of flood attenuation that it provides is far, far less than, say, you know, what the general public frequently thinks of as a wetland, the swamp that has cattails and has water in it year-round. And so that's one of the things where I keep repeating myself here, I think that there ought to be greater focus on when we evaluate our wetland resources, evaluating what can be impacted needs to be put in the context of the functions and values and of those services and benefits that are being provided to society, and be able to measure those. And I don't know that we're ever going to come up with an exact measurement that we're all going to agree on. But anyway, just focusing on those functions and values, recognizing those differences, and then in our Goal 5 land use planning laws, where we say that we're going to concentrate our development in cities and towns, then I think we're going to have to make some choices about what we can sacrifice and what we can't.
Follow up briefly, one more.
The extent to which wetlands serve to filter our groundwater system, could you just make a guess at what proportion of the work that's done, as you refer to it here, the load, is carried out by thousands and thousands of little tiny pieces as opposed to single major swamps or bogs or marshes? I mean, is it 5% versus 95% the big ones, or is it 50-50? And what's the magnitude of these thousands of little pieces?
I guess I'm not sure that in terms of, say, a function like groundwater recharge.
Yes, any of those three functions you mentioned.
I don't consider myself an expert on that part of wetland scientists. I would hate to venture a guess here, you know, because there's obviously lots of groundwater recharge going on in non-wetland areas as well. And to say what proportion is happening in which type of wetland, I don't feel that I have the expertise to answer that adequately.
Perhaps one of our other witnesses might comment on that. I mean, if we did away with these thousands of little pieces, would it matter to our water system?
I think we're going to have testimony from water resource people perhaps a little later on, representative, that might help. We didn't really expect to grill you like this morning.
Consultants.
We really appreciate the fact that you're taking the time to answer these questions.
I appreciate that. I appreciate the opportunity. Having also been a former Oregon State University Extension Service employee and taught college classes, being in a position of instructor is one that I enjoy.
Mr. Lynch, thank you very much.
Thank you for this opportunity.
It is becoming obvious to the chair that we're probably not going to get to House Bill 2610 or 2611 this morning. So any of you folks that were here for those bills can probably take off and feel pretty safe. In that we still have 8 people to speak 2431, and we have 90 minutes left, so we'll try to contain the testimony to about 10 minutes per person at this point in order to get done.
Does our session start at 10:30 today rather than 11?
The floor session?
I think the floor session starts at 10:30 today.
Does anyone know what time the floor session?
10:30.
Yeah. It does start at 10:30. So we have even less time. Okay. So, in other words, we'll be moving right along here now. Charles Link. Again, this is based on distance, and then we will... Now, after Mr. Link speaks, revert back to the top of the sign-up sheet.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Link.
My name's Charles Link. I live at 411 Horizon Hill Road in Yahatch, Oregon. I'm here to support House Bill 2431 for a number of reasons, which I will try to explain. As a way of introduction, I'm an AT&T retiree. I spent 30 years with AT&T and Pacific Northwest Bell before retiring in 1998. The majority of that career was in the regulatory area. And while it was telecom regulation as opposed to wetland regulation, I am familiar with a lot of regulation rules as they relate to the state, the federal, and also I was involved in international countries, particularly in India, China, parts of Asia. So I've helped design regulatory processes, I've implemented regulatory processes, and so it's from that perspective I'm coming. Shortly after moving to Yahatch in 1999, I purchased 2 acres of R4 high-density residential property in the Yahatch city limits. I also obtained options to purchase 2 additional adjacent lots. In preparation for the purchase, I hired a wetland specialist. A portion of the purchased property and all of the property under option had been determined to be wetlands by an employee of the Division of State Lands in 1997. The wetland specialist told me that if I agreed to mitigation, these artificially created wetlands, I say artificially created wetlands, could be developed easily. In 2000, my wife and I secured conditional approval from the city of Yahatch to develop a 40-unit condominium development. We also obtained agreement from the city of Toledo for a $50,000 payment for enhancing a wetlands area on the Kena Bay. On May 23, 2000, a fill permit application was made with the Department of State Lands, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, to fill 1.67 acres in the Yahatch site by my wetlands consultant, and that was for that $50,000 payment to the city of Toledo. On August 3rd, I received copies of 8 letters that were comments on the fill proposal that had been solicited by the Army Corps and DSL. Only 2 of the letters stated opposition, one from a group calling its friends the Friends of the Oregon Shores, and another from a part-time Yahatch resident. The other 6 letters were either supportive or advisory in nature. I received advice from my wetlands consultant to call a DSL staff member. I placed the call to the employee at DSL, and he told me that the Army Corps employee had issues with the proposal that he did not understand. He suggested I talk to the Army Corps employee. I talked to the Army Corps employee, who was extremely curt, and it was clear that any issues that existed weren't going to be cleared up on that telephone conversation, so I forced an on-site meeting. This meeting was held in August and involved the U.S. Army Corps and DSL employees, the builder who was to be my partner in the venture, my wetlands specialist, and an employee from the Department of Environmental Quality who'd been invited by the Army Corps employee, unbeknownst to me. During the course of this discussion, the DSL employee expressed his opinion that whether the site was truly wetlands was highly arguable, and that my partner and I should continue to pursue a fill permit. It was also evident that some form of disagreement had developed between my wetlands consultant and the Army Corps employee, but it was out of earshot, so we couldn't tell what was happening. Evidence had been submitted to DSL and the Army Corps that as a result, in part, of an off-site drainage misplacement on the part of ODOT, that developed an artificial wetlands condition. And during a heavy downpour, which we get a lot of on the Oregon coast, the land became wet. However, there's no natural waterway that exists on the property, underground or overground or anything else. No fish, not navigable, not otherwise. Only habitat for things like discarded building materials and old Christmas trees and blocks of concrete. Both DSL and Army Corps employee were asked if we could expect any sort of written guidance as to how to resolve the issues in question. Both declined any formal guidance. The meeting ended without resolution or any clue as to how to move forward, at least as far as my partner and I were concerned. As a result, I retained a new attorney and, at his suggestion, a new wetlands specialist. After a meeting with the new wetlands specialist, she indicated she didn't understand why the parcel couldn't be developed since everything around it was, including a motel, a condominium, and single-family housing. Also, in this time frame, DSL changed employees responsible for the area. Since nothing was being resolved, and since at least from our perspective, we didn't even understand what the issues were, we decided to try to schedule another on-site meeting, get everybody together, including the new players now, and try to see what could be done to develop this property. During the course of the meeting, it was decided that to satisfy the Army Corps, the project had to be cut from 40 units to 22 units, that no multifamily units could be built on the front two parcels under option. This seemed to settle it with the Army Corps of Engineers. However, the new DSL employee had a list of new things that restricted the development of the back 2 acres that I wanted to, but she couldn't explain them all. All I know is we started talking about some of them, and it totally destroyed the drainage plan that I spent a ton of money with an engineering firm to develop. But still we didn't have a clear understanding of what those issues were. I was asked to yet submit another plan for approval. And the Ahat City Planner then came back to me and says, well, since you've been cut back from 40 to 22 units, of course you have to come back to the Planning Commission now for reapproval. And by about this time, this was getting pretty expensive. And we were also starting to move into the recession that many of you have experienced. By this time, between land purchase price, design fees, engineering studies, wetland specialists, attorney fees, I'd already invested over $250,000 in this parcel of property with nothing on it. And so the risks versus the rewards were no longer attractive to me. As a result of all of this, a $10 million project was never developed. Contractors, builders, laborers were never employed. Governments never realized potential property taxes on the units. Income taxes from employees and developers were never realized in the Oregon coffers. In summary, this was one of the most convoluted regulatory processes that I've ever experienced. Remember, I've dealt in a lot of them. The best regulatory processes are transparent, understandable, or not subject to the individual whims of governmental employees. And while I realize Oregon lawmakers have little control over federal employees, I suggest they do what they can to support processes that properly balance property rights of the owners who have put their money where their mouth is, and less so on people who have no legitimate interests in that property. House Bill 2431 moves us in that direction. First, it establishes firm timelines that are more reasonable than those currently in place, or at least those being implemented. Secondly, establishes remedies for escalation, sometimes in place of costly litigation procedures. Third, it places more responsibility on the government agency that makes a decision that compromises an owner's property rights. Fourth, it helps to rationalize apparently conflicting federal, state, and local planning processes. And finally, it removes from state regulation property that should never have been regulated in the first place, that is, artificially and accidentally created wetlands. While I recognize this may not be good politics, it is good government, and it's good economics. And if any of you are interested, I can supply whatever documentation you might require to pursue this further. I drove over here in a Miata instead of a Mack truck, so it's, but I'd be happy to produce whatever you need.
Can you leave a copy of your written... do you have a copy of your written...
Yes.
If you would leave that with us, we'd appreciate that very much. Any questions, Mr. Lane? Thank you, sir, for coming. Doug Tindall.
Thank you. Chair Gerard, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Doug Tindall. I'm the state maintenance engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I will be brief. The bill appears that it's attempting to streamline the process of permitting. A fairly good example of what you just heard is I can tell you that private citizens are not the only ones that are subject to that kind of a process. Our concerns about the bill are that we've tried to develop a collaborative process in dealing with all of the regulators at once, and we have some concern that the bill as written may unlink some cooperative opportunities between Division of State Lands and the Corps of Engineers. I don't think that's a fatal flaw. It's just something that appears in the bill that may happen. The second concern we have, also mentioned by the first testifier, Mr. Lorenz, is the $20,000 fee for mitigation bank credits. We use to move transportation projects forward, we buy mitigation credits, or we in ways get mitigation credits, and we like that process. Our concern is that if the price is established and fixed at too low a level to encourage development of wetland mitigation banks, that we may not be able to take advantage of purchasing those credits. So those are our concerns with the bill. Chair Girard.
Any questions of Mr. Tindall? Representative Zahner.
Thank you, Mr. Girard. Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Good to see you. Listen to testimony over the last few weeks. There's a lot of duplication between the Corps of Engineers and Department of State Lands. You think that's true? I mean, just the last testimony.
Chair Girard, Representative Zahner, I would say yes, but at least in what ODOT is trying to move forward, and I think with success, not only with Division of State Lands and the Corps of Engineers, but with Department of Environmental Quality, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, National Marine Fisheries, U.S. Fish, all of those agencies that we deal with, and in terms of getting permits, we're trying to work collaboratively with all of those organizations to streamline the process so it's essentially a once-and-done sort of a thing for a transportation project, to bring them all to the table.
Thank you. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Tindall, you're in a unique position because you have a lot of experience, but you're here for ODOT. I'd like you to take off your ODOT hat and take on an Oregonian's hat and tell us, based on your experience, if you were a landowner such as Mr. Link, who just was here, knowing what you know, what would you do to this bill to make it more responsive and user-friendly for citizens?
Chair Girard, Representative Richardson, let me tell you a little bit about sort of my background. I'm an engineer, and we build roads, and what we try and do is build roads in a way that certainly does not harm the environment, if not improve it. I'm not an expert in fill removal permitting or the basis for wetland mitigation, so I'm not sure I can answer your question, but essentially what I think encouraging the use of mitigation banks is something that would help. I'm not sure if it would help Mr. Link, but as Mr. Lorenz suggested, that is certainly a way that could actually be more effective than what we're currently doing. Making sure that the Division of State Lands is not put in a corner where they cannot implement laws on it's a particular Corps permit, a 404 permit, so that the Corps would take that back and say, we've got to do this because the Division of State Lands is pinned and can't do what the Corps of Engineers considers to be an adequate job. So that's about the best answer I can give.
Hello.
You, sir.
Do you feel like this bill gives greater flexibility to the Division of Lands?
Chair Girard, Representative Richardson, I think as it's worded, it might take some away. It appeared to us that it might take some of that away and make it more difficult to build that collaborative process.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Bennett. John Lilly, Division of State Lands.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's my first time before your committee. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good morning, John.
Especially enjoyed some of the presentations made before I came to you today. I think Mr. Lorenz presented a very good case for some of the that's supportive of some of the testimony that I'm going to give you this morning. The division does not support the bill in its current form because it changes the existing removal fill permitting process as to create confusion and uncertainty for permit applicants. While we believe the bill sponsors have other goals in mind, the effect of the bill, if implemented, would likely increase the loss of wetland acres and compromise the state's ongoing efforts to do one-stop permitting through a combining of the state and federal permitting programs at the state level. The bill focuses on wetland permitting, mitigation exemptions, and permit processing. We will not address all these, but try to focus on some of the key issues of the greatest importance.
Mr. Dulley, can I just for
certainly
a question right off the bat here? Why is having less wetlands necessarily bad?
It may not necessarily be bad, Mr. Chair. The current public policy in the state of Oregon is that we're trying to maintain wetland acres and wetland functions at more or less their current level through the permitting process. In part, that's because of the great amount of wetland acres that have been lost through a lot of good reasons, but and some maybe not so good. But at the current time, we're at where we are, and current public policy, as I'll point out in my testimony later, and as is currently established in state law, gives a priority to wetland conservation. Now, that does not mean that every acre of wetland as it sits today is to be preserved in its current condition, but rather that over time wetlands are protected, and if they are filled then under the removal fill program, then there's compensation for that filling so that those functions can be carried out in some other location. So we're looking for the federal policy is no net loss. The state policy is no change in acres and function. And that's primarily the public policy as to why we have a permitting program. Now, you heard some pretty good testimony this morning already. Mr. Link's testimony was very good and points out some of the issues that we're trying to address in this permit streamlining project that the division is working on. He also points out some what I would call customer service issues that need to be addressed, and which we are addressing within the division at the current time. Mr. Lorenz addressed a number of issues that are important. The functional assessments, how we decide which wetland, and you begin to point in at that. What are the important wetlands? What are the ones that ought to be, say, protected and conserved, and what are the ones that are of less value socially or otherwise and can be filled, and then what is the public consequence to doing that? Those, we believe, are the public policy questions that this bill begs. We have some answers to those, and if I may proceed, I'd carry that out as my testimony.
And I appreciate your explanation.
The public policy questions that we see presented in this bill are, one, should the state of Oregon allow a wetland to be filled without a permit, public or adjacent landowner review, by requiring only that payment be made to a mitigation account? And number two, should the state's removal fill program differ markedly from the federal program? Number three, should there be responsibility for applicants to demonstrate that they have avoided and or minimized filling wetlands with their project? And number four, what is the appropriate amount or type of compensation for applicants to contribute to mitigation to mitigate for the unavoidable loss of wetlands caused through development, and what is the appropriate amount for the public to contribute? Number five, is there a need to promote large mitigation banks over smaller ones? Number six, are there ways to speed up the permit issuance process? And number seven, would the enactment of House Bill 2431 further the state's policy of conserving wetlands and making the best use of water resources of the state? Now, there are probably any testifier who would come before you would probably give you their own spin about what they think the public policy questions are. And there are probably more in this bill than what we've outlined here. But at least what we've put before you is, we think, the key questions that are raised in this bill. Wetlands are areas I believe it was Representative Richardson's question. Wetlands are areas where water covers the soil or is present either at or near the surface of the soil all year or for varying periods of time during the year, including the growing season. Water saturation or hydrology largely determines how the soil develops and the types of plants and animal communities living in the soil. Wetlands may support both aquatic and land or terrestrial-based species. The prolonged absence or presence of water, rather, creates conditions that favor the growth of specially adapted plants.
Mr. Lilly, I'm sorry. Representative Richards.
Mr. Chair, 2 weeks. Mr. Lilly, who set the this parameter that 2 weeks worth of sitting water would be considered a wetland. Is that federal or is that state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, the state of Oregon uses the Corps of Engineers delineation manual. This was a manual put together, in my understanding, by a group of scientists who study these sorts of things. There are actually folks in your audience this morning who are much more versed on the terms and conditions of that manual and even the scientific basis behind it than I am. But fundamentally, state law says that we'll use a consistent approach to identifying and delineating wetlands in Oregon, and we use the Corps of Engineers manual. We also have, by administrative rule, established the standards for how wetlands are identified and the types of documentation necessary to prove up that a wetland actually exists on a property or doesn't exist.
Follow up. Does that include artificially created or accidentally created wetlands?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, there are ways in the manual in which to determine whether a wetland is artificially created or not. Current Division of State Lands rule allows that artificially created wetlands, if they're less than an acre, are not subject to regulation. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some other nuances there, but determining the source of the hydrology and how the wetland occurred is an important aspect of determining whether or not it's wetland is jurisdictional. That is, is it subject to regulation? The next thing is, if it is subject to regulation, then what is the activity that's being proposed? Because in some cases, even the landowner's activity may not be regulated under state or federal law.
Mm-hmm. One final one. This may be a little bit different from what you're reading to us, but in your position with state lands, you had mentioned that there's work towards streamlining the permit process and so forth. If you were to compare the work that was done 2 years ago with what's being done presently, are the citizens of Oregon being better served now than they were 2 years ago? Is it more streamlined now than it was 2 years ago, or are we talking about intentions as compared to results?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, there's no doubt in my mind that we are doing a better job towards streamlining and presenting this program to the people of Oregon today than we were 2 years ago.
It is faster now,
yes,
and more streamlined.
Yes, sir. And to follow up, in the last legislative session, Senate Bill 529 was passed. Very important piece of legislation. It went into effect this past July. What's important is that Mr. Link's problem would not be the one he is faced with. Back up. The problem Mr. Link faced in getting the agency to make a permit decision would not be what he would face today, because current law says we have 40 days to make a determination as whether the application is complete. We have then 90 days to make a permit decision, unless the applicant wants more time for that decision to be made. Otherwise, the agency is bound by state law and by our own administrative rules to make the permit decision. So there would not be any of this finger-pointing back and forth and going, I mean, that might happen in the application stage when there's a question about whether the application is complete and the details of what is necessary to help make the decision. But our instructions to staff are to do everything they can to get that application complete as quickly as possible, make that review, get the job done, and move on. In fact, if we were able to offer amendments to this bill, we would offer amendments in that regard in terms of the application review period being a little shorter than it currently is under state law.
Thank you.
Mr. Lilly, and all of those of you who have testified before this committee, I want to give you a warning. We know enough to be dangerous, so be prepared for questions that may appear to you to be a little basic, but this committee needs to be educated, and so we're taking the time that we feel is necessary to learn this very important issue. So have patience with our committee. We're well-intentioned. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I just want to follow up on your last comment, Mr. Lee. There is a process to adjudicate whether a parcel of property is or is not a wetland. Is that what I understand?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that's exactly correct.
That, however, does commit the division to making that determination as a necessity, as on a case-by-case basis. Is that correct? Rather than a broader basis as to categorizing and mapping what may be wetland areas, so the public is what is better informed as what is a wetland and what is not a wetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, actually, the state law has delegated to the division to work with local government and to do exactly as you've described. We have probably three levels of assessment of the presence of wetlands in the state of Oregon. The first level is what is called the National Wetland Inventory. That is an inventory that was done on a state-by-state basis at a high level of scale by the U.S. United States Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm not sure how recent that mapping was done. They're updating the maps from time to time. The second level is more discrete than that, and it's on a community basis. It's what we call a local wetland inventory. It's often done by local government, usually within urban growth boundaries, because that's where the majority of development pressure comes and where this rub occurs between the pressures to preserve resources and the pressures to develop them. Those inventories, I believe we have upwards of 80 different local wetland inventories that have been completed. They've been reviewed and approved by the agency, by the Division of State Lands, and adopted by the individual local governments. The third level is a more site-specific level. And oftentimes, realtors, property owners, developers, people who want to know whether they have wetlands on their property in order to or other jurisdictional waters, in order to determine whether or not how that presence or absence of a wetland or jurisdictional water might affect their plans to use their property. We do what's called a wetland determination or a wetland delineation. Now, some of the people in the audience are wetland consultants, and that work makes up a part of their business. And they go in the field, and they meet with property owners, and they follow the manual, and then they follow our rules and present us a report, and the division reviews those reports in order to determine whether or not there's the presence or absence of wetland. We do about 600 of those types of projects a year. They're all submitted by landowners or local government or consultants. We do that work at no cost. The result is that a landowner has a decision, an appealable decision from the Division of State Lands as to whether or not wetlands or jurisdictional waters are present upon their land.
Thank you. Continue, Mr.
I'm not usually one who would read my testimony, but some of this is rather technical, and I want to make sure I get it across correctly. So if you'll abide with me, I appreciate it. I want to pick up where, in the middle of the paragraph, the top of page 2, where we're talking about wetlands vary widely because of regional and local differences in soil, topography, climate, hydrology, the chemistry of the water, vegetation, other factors, including human disturbance. Now, to the point that was raised earlier about, well, what is the social value of wetlands? Clearly, wetlands are a form on the landscape that performs some functions. You've heard about those, and Mr. Lorenz mentioned functions as a very critical aspect of this whole permitting game. Wetlands perform a wide range of functions and social values, including floodwater storage, fish and wildlife habitat, sediment trapping, improvement of water quality and open space and education. Now, if you're downstream of someone who has a seasonal wetland on their property, where that water sits on that property throughout the wet season and isn't coming down on your property, you're pretty happy that wetland exists. We have heard from folks through the permitting process who are concerned about large scale or even small scale filling of these smaller seasonal wetlands on property in their vicinity because it pushes water one way or the other. Now, some communities have ordinances and regulations that deal with stormwater management. but oftentimes the removal fill permit is the first opportunity for those issues to be vetted in the public arena as to whether or not benefits are derived from the storage of water on adjacent lands. While not every wetland is pristine or significant, all perform some of these functions that I've described. Many wetlands, even those that have been highly altered, have the potential to function at a higher level, and that's what mitigation is about. Because frequently, when as has been described by prior testifiers, when a permit is issued, it includes something along the lines of a mitigation plan, and that mitigation plan may include going to a lower functioning wetland and doing improvement to that wetland to increase its function and therefore its quality as a wetland. It's kind of like taking lessons from Tiger Woods. If you're a mediocre golfer and you take a couple lessons from Tiger and get the right clubs, maybe you'll hit a little farther. That's kind of what wetland mitigation is about. It's about taking lower functioning wetlands and trying to improve them in their function or quality.
Mr. Lynn? Mr. Green would like to ask a question.
Certainly.
Yeah, can I? You may have heard me ask this question before. This issue of small pieces of wetland versus large. You now explained the three maps we have. You have some sense of the magnitude again of the function performed by the relatively isolated small pieces compared to the huge. I'm not looking for a precise answer. I just want to know: is it a de minimis amount, or is it a significant amount in terms of what the...
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Greenlake, it really does depend where that particular wetland, however small, sits on the landscape. For example, think of a slope with a spring. Sometimes you see these in eastern Oregon, down below the rim rock. That spring is seeping out of the ground. It's leaving a trail of water that runs downhill. Within that trail of water, there's vegetation that could be termed wetland type vegetation. Those are often, if they're large enough, if they have the qualities of a wetland, are the kinds of things that are small and yet significant in that overall landscape. Now, on the other hand, think into an area maybe in your own neighborhood that's undeveloped but is isolated, it's been cut off or subject to just water flowing into it as a result of drainage in the area, where it really doesn't seem to perform much function except to create an opportunity for folks to throw McDonald's cartons and things of that nature in. We call those shopping cart wetlands. They're small, they tend to be rather very degraded. Those, one would argue, really don't perform much function, and maybe filling those to perform other social functions is acceptable. Under the division's current rules, those kinds of things are permissible, and you can then take do mitigation by providing either buying credits from a bank or paying into the mitigation account that the state has, and the state then would do the mitigation for it.
Follow up, Paul?
Yeah, no, I understand that. I mean, and I have a piece of land in eastern Oregon that has exactly one of those with a spring head. My question is one of social policy, which is why I keep asking. Let's say we did away with all these tiny little wetlands. Would it make any difference in terms of the function of the state? Or would we lose half of the water purification function of the state if we did away with all these little pieces? And you may not be able to answer it, but the issue of social policy is, I understand keeping the Malheur National Bird Refuge in place, but I sense that there's a lot of the work is done by a lot of these small places around, and that we might be a lot worse off if we didn't have a social policy that protected those. And that's what I'm trying to get some sense of the magnitude of.
Committee, just as a point of information, we do have another bill we'll be considering that would eliminate all wetlands within urban growth.
There we go. Well, this would be very helpful for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, let me take another whack at it. The importance of wetlands, large or small, can depend upon where they sit in the landscape and what function they're currently presenting. the goal of the permitting process at the first step is to assure that we've made conscious decisions to evaluate the right, the appropriateness of filling a wetland, regardless of where it is in the landscape and how well it functions. Now, to give you a definitive answer in terms of a quantitative answer, I think you're right. There's probably experts more wise than I who might be able to do that. And maybe they're in this room, and we'll have an opportunity to present that to you later.
Thank you, Mr. Lloyd.
To continue my testimony, I've stated already what the state's policy is relative and the federal policy relative to wetland loss, but it's important, I think, to state that under ORS 196-672, the policy of the state is to promote the protection, conservation, and best use of wetland resources, their functions and values through integration and close coordination, statewide planning goals, local government plans, and state and federal regulatory programs. In Oregon, as well as in other states, we regulate development of wetlands to ensure that there is no net loss of freshwater wetlands and that estuarine wetlands are on the increase. And we're able to do that as a result of some of the restoration projects going on where tidally influenced wetlands are being reconnected or previously diked wetlands are being reconnected to estuaries. Current Oregon law and the division's rules for permitting seek to achieve these goals through timely and efficient and fair permitting. The division reviews and approves about 30 to 50 permits impacting wetlands per year. Typically, project impacts are about 1 acre or less and probably 50% or less than a half acre or less. Projects approved only after an applicant has demonstrated that all the alternatives have been considered and the project design is avoided and as the wetland as much as possible or minimize the impact area. In addition, there is public review of each application. And finally, when all those assurances are met, the applicant might need to provide compensatory mitigation to offset or compensate for the loss of wetland area and function caused by the development. And the rules and law allow for a number of options for an applicant to meet those requirements. First, an applicant can restore, enhance a wetland area at the project site or nearby. They can arrange for a third party to do the mitigation work at another location. They can pay into an account kept by the division, and the division will then find a project, and that's called payment to provide. Or they can buy credits from an established mitigation bank. There are currently 6 banks in the state of Oregon. Several are in the planning stage. Most of the banks, well, all of the banks currently operating in Western Oregon. Because compensatory mitigation is still a trial and error process, the division requires that more acres be restored or enhanced than are impacted. This is the ratio question that you heard discussed prior. The ratios allow for the fact that we're not very precise in the science yet and the technique of recreating and restoring wetland functions. And so, To put it simply, we're trying to make it up in volume, hoping that by doing an enhancement, the enhancement ratio under current rule restoration, if one is restoring a wetland, that's a 1-to-1 ratio. If creation is taking place, it's a 1.5 acres to 1 acre of impact. If enhancement is being done, enhancement is improving a particular function of a wetland to an already existing wetland, that's a 3-to-1 ratio. Enhancement of cropped wetland is 2-to-1. The purpose of ratios, again, is to try to increase the success. Wetland mitigation success in terms of restoration, enhancement, creation is still evolving. And one of the things that's difficult is to assure that what you set out to do in a restoration or mitigation project is actually going to occur. until such time, the federal permitting program operates in a similar manner, and until such time as the two programs are merged at the state level, it's imperative that the methods of operation be coordinated. The bill appears to establish a process that differs from current law by allowing mitigation payments to be made in advance of the permitting actually happening, and without any public review or without including adjacent property owners. Now, a key point here is that the cost of wetland compensatory mitigation is being addressed in the bill. The current public policy, as I've said, is expected to find that where the applicant is expected to find and fund the necessary mitigation. This is viewed as compensation replacement for developing a resource of public significance and social value. The costs may approach or exceed the value of the unimproved land being developed and make a project uneconomical. On the other hand, many projects do pencil out, as vis-a-vis we've authorized 30 to 50 of these a year, and it may pencil out as profitable because the developed land values in the end far exceed the cost of mitigation. Some argue that these costs are excessive and the public should bear more of the burden of paying for the mitigation. The bill sets limits on these payments and thereby attempts to rebalance what is believed to be inequities. The effect of the current policy is to use market techniques to steer development away from wetland resources that provide a range of functions and values to the public at large. I've included documentation here as to what we experience in terms of cost for wetland mitigation. I won't belabor you with those words. You can look at them here. And just in final, let me wrap up by saying the program that the division operates under the state law has been in existence since 1967. We issue about 1,000 permits a year in the recent years, probably more than 10,000 over the life of the program as it currently exists. And while some new projects require prior approval, as I've stated before, many do not. And in fact, putting less than 50 cubic yards in a wetland for the purposes of housing development would not require a permit from the state, although it may require a permit from the federal government. We are, just to close, you've been very patient with me, I appreciate it. But just to close, I would say that we have a number of issues with the bill. I think that the current rules that we're operating under are much improved over the past practice. I think over a three-year period, we've met a lot with the public, with folks like Mr. Link, although this is the first time I've met him or seen him, and a lot of the consultants and local governments. There are probably things that we can do better on the customer service side. No question. Every program can do better, and we would strive to do so. But bottom line is, I think that we've got the basis for a pretty good program. The policy issues here are clear. We look forward to working with the bill sponsors or the committee on amendments that could improve the current program, and we'd be glad to do so.
Any further questions of Mr. Lilly? Representative Rosenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lilly, could you just briefly explain how a mitigation bank works under the current system?
Simply put, and there are people in the audience actually who operate mitigation banks, and you may want to talk to them as well, I would hope. The division certifies that a bank meets the requirements of state law and the division's rules. A banker starts with a piece of land that has some potential as wetland. Either there's wetland there or there's restorable wetland. There's a baseline established as to what the existing functions and the extent of the wetland that exist on the site. Then they do improvements to gain credits or increase the function of the wetland, which credits are derived from that. And then in a free market exchange, the banker and a permit applicant have a transaction, and credits are purchased from the bank, which then compensate the banker for the investment that they've made in developing the bank. This all happens typically within the private sector. We don't have any private public banks as yet, although there are some agencies that are looking into that.
No follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow.
So if I'm a landowner and I want to purchase these credits as I've gotten the permit approved, am I usually purchasing credits for a project that has already been completed and just negotiating to pay for it, or are these projects done kind of in response to a landowner's need to buy credits?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I think if I don't get your question, answer your question exactly right, try again. I'd like to try to get it correct. An applicant for a permit may come to the point, well, in our current rules, if the project is under 0.2 acres of wetland fill, they don't need the permittee doesn't need to go and do mitigation on site or anything like that. They can go and find buy credits from a bank or pay the payment to provide account of the state. But in the case of a small project like that, if there's a bank within the area where the project is being done, they can go to the banker and arrange to buy the credits. We then acknowledge that as the mitigation in the permit, in the terms and conditions of the permit.
I guess, final follow-up, I guess what I'm not getting, though, is what's the oversight to ensure that what I'm buying and how much I'm paying for it is objectively an offset for what I would have had to do on the project that I want to build on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, the state, the Division of State Lands, in overseeing the issuance of the permit, looks at the transaction, not so much for the amount of money transacted, but rather is there balance in terms of the credits for the impacts.
Representative Richardson.
I have one question. Having heard the testimony earlier by Mr. Lorenz, would you agree that functions and values should be given consideration in place of or in addition to area for area?
Representative Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, absolutely. Current law says that basically under RS 196.825, compensatory wetland mitigation shall be limited to replacement of the functional attributes of the lost wetland. The problem...
Now, you said functional attributes, not necessarily the value of... I mean, if...
They're somewhat synonymous.
I mean, how does it work?
They're somewhat synonymous in their terminology. The statute uses the term functional attributes. The sense in the regulated community and by the division is that functions and values are similar. The problem, quite frankly, is that as Mr. Lorenz points out, is there's not common agreement across the board as to how one assesses functional attributes or functions and values. The state has the division has an approved methodology for purposes of planning at the Goal 5 land use planning level, but that's a higher level of scale than for a particular project site. We have been working on a functional assessment methodology called hydrogeomorphic methodology. Dr. Adamus in the audience is the nationally known expert in that area. However, I would think we're a ways from actually implementing that, any particular ordained, if you will, functional assessment methodology at this time. And so the chemistry that we do use in the regulatory environment is asking people under our current rules, applicants bring forward their best assessment of functional attributes with their best documentation they can. We don't say that they have to use a particular methodology, just that it's documented and they address the general values, floodwater storage, etc. And then we look towards the ratios to give us some amount of acreage that's going to approximate some of those functions. And that's because many functions are dependent upon size of the area, flood attention, flood storage, for example. So if you were asking me, if I thought there was a need for as Mr. Lorenz has mentioned, is there a need for a commonly agreed upon set of methodologies for functional attributes, I agree. And it's something that the agency is working on. Whether or not it needs to be in statute or not, I think is a good, it's something that's worth debate. There are pluses and minuses for that kind of thing. The agency is working on, a 2 to 3 year trajectory to have a functional assessment methodology in place that is agreed upon, possibly established by administrative rule, that would include vetting at the public level and including consultants and scientists and the regulated public at large.
Mr. Lilly, I think the committee might be interested in seeing just how far the agency is in that direction. If you could bring us some kind of written report on that, I think that would help our education.
Mr. Chair, on the functional assessment process, certainly, we'd be glad to do so.
Any further questions of Mr. Lilly? We again thank you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you for your indulgence allowing me to take so much time.
No. Scott Duchette.
Thank you, Chair Girard and committee. I am going to provide some written testimony, but I'm not going to read it today. I'll leave it to you.
Thanks you for that.
Pardon me? I was hoping you would.
We do frown upon people who sit here and just read
and
to
read.
We usually can read ourselves.
I figured that you guys would like the chance to read it yourselves. So there's a few points in here that I'll just hit quickly. And then I wanted to take the opportunity to respond to a few of the questions I heard this morning and see if maybe I can vocalize some of my background for that.
I'm going to have about 15 to 20 minutes to do that.
Okay, so. And I probably will make it shorter than that, if that's all right, right, sir. I'm with the City of Eugene, and I'm the Wetlands and Open Waterways Manager there. We have one of the largest, most successful mitigation banks in the nation. It's been presented to groups and committees in almost 30 states on how we approach the issue of wetlands in our community. And we feel that it's a very good model for other communities to look at. The situation was in late 1980s, Eugene was expanding. As you know, timber was declining in that time period, and we started to put in the infrastructure for industry in West Eugene. At the same time that we were putting in streets and sewers, we also were told that most of that area is wetlands, and we would have some hurdles to jump in order to develop. We put together a plan with the community to do exactly what some folks had suggested today, which is go out there, look at the wetlands, determine which ones are worthy of protection and which ones might not be. And that resulted in identifying about 1,200 acres of wetlands inside our urban growth boundary, about 900 of which were deemed valuable enough to either protect or to restore them. And we have approximately 300 acres of that which was deemed low enough quality that we want to go ahead and develop those wetlands. And the tool that we developed to do that is a mitigation bank that is an agreement between the Eugene District Bureau of Land Management, the City of Eugene, and the Nature Conservancy, along with the regulatory agencies. And to get at Representative Rosenbaum's question, we go out and restore wetlands each summer. We have crews of folks. We hire local contractors with earthwork equipment. We collect native seeds. We plant the seeds out on these former agricultural fields. And after we do that, we then bank a credit, which is then available for a developer or the city or other local governments to purchase. So when folks come to us, they're filling a wetland. They've got their permit. They're going to pay into our bank and get their credits taken care of so they can move on with their development process. We're going to take that money and put it into an account that we specifically use just for going out and restoring these wetlands, which we've already identified as being valuable enough to the community to protect and restore. So that's the way our mitigation bank operates. Kind of got off the track of my comments here. I'll come back to them because I think it's more interesting to respond to some of the questions that were posed here. Let me see. I have those written down here. Okay. Representative Richardson asked about why swamps are important. And I'll say that I'm a third-generation Oregonian. My grandfather helped build the dams on the Willamette, and my father and uncles were involved in logging, and I grew up doing some of that myself. Went on to school in natural resources because I liked being out of doors, and through that process I was, should I say, enlightened to some of the benefits of wetlands. And I do think they're important for society. I do think we should have a balanced approach, but they do provide things such as flood storage, biodiversity, which is growing in importance, as we know. We're discovering new medicines, new cures through from nature. The number of species that are out there helps keep infectious diseases at bay. In addition to the flood storage and the biodiversity, the water quality benefits, the filtering that's going on, it removes heavy metals from our industrial areas, fertilizers and pesticides from our yards and gardens. And so wetlands are really performing a lot of social values for us. They're out there. But I know that the historical view of wetlands has been that they are swamps and we should either be able to hunt ducks, fish in them, or fill them. And I do think there's some higher values that are associated with those wetlands that are worthy of protection. Getting at the third question I wanted to respond to, Chair.
Yes,
sorry.
Representative Richards.
Stop me there?
Yeah, just Mr. Duckett. Before you go further, I have no problem with marshlands. My concern is for the property owner who has a high clay content in his vacant lot that will hold water for 2.5 weeks mm-hmm. in May and gets held to the same standards as a marsh that's around, you know, that is year-round, or some other area that, you know, that has migratory bird pattern use and those kinds of things. Do you feel, when you say that you want a balanced approach, that the current standard is a balanced approach where you have one extreme being held to the same standard as the other?
That's a tricky question, but I would say it is, and the reason I would say that I think it is balanced or that it's fair is right now the estimates are that we have approximately 1% of the historic wetlands that were in the Willamette Valley at time of settlement. And because of that, even some of these small little wetlands on lots in the middles of cities are important because when a developer fills them and is held to high standards to do the offset mitigation, we're really starting from below zero and trying to work our way back up to keeping some of the original historic wetlands that we had here. And that's important because there are several species that live only here in the wetlands in the Willamette Valley. Several of them are on the endangered species list now. And protecting those from a biodiversity standpoint is important so we don't lose those species. So I think there's a little bit of, when we get into the fairness issue, it seems that now we're starting to pay for some of the past practices perhaps that didn't pay for draining or removing wetlands. So I guess it's, you know, individuals' choices on whether it's balanced or fair, but the way that our program is running in West Eugene, I think it's working very well. Developers who fill the little, you know, degraded wetland when they're building a subdivision pay into our bank, and we are building or creating new wetlands or restoring wetlands, actually, with literally over 100 species of hand-collected native seeds that are declining. So I think it's getting there.
I would like to follow up on the representative.
Sorry.
Excuse me, sir.
Scott, back to the bill, because you're concerned with the city of Eugene. If you were excluded from the bill, would you be okay?
Well, I would say we'd be okay, but okay. I guess
thank
from
you.
The... Okay, I'll leave it at that.
Representative Greenwich, did you...
I just did want to follow up just a bit on Representative Richardson's question. I mean, it impresses me what you said is that we don't treat all wetlands exactly the same. You said you picked 900 acres to save and 300 acres to do away with.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether that lot that has a little water on it for 2.5 weeks is treated in the wetland mitigation process the same way that a natural marsh would be treated.
Chair Garrard and Representative Greenlick, the that small lot, getting into some details here, but I'll just share that within the boundary of where we did our study, most of those wetlands have already been identified, and it's set as to what they're going to be in the future. They're either going to be developed or they're going to be restored. However, around the rest of the Eugene Springfield metro area, we service those wetlands that are getting filled as well with our mitigation bank. So the small lot that's getting developed is either has already been identified in the plan as being something to go ahead and develop, or it's outside our planned area and we haven't gone out there to look at them yet. And so it runs through the same permitting process that other permits would run through.
Thank you, sir. Any further questions, Mr. McKinley?
Okay, well, you have my testimony there, and if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them later.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the testimony. Paul Adamus? Did I get it right or wrong, Paul?
Adamus.
Radio guy strikes out again.
It's a social issue.
We intend to adjourn the committee somewhere around 20 after the hour, so we'll kind of keep that in mind as we go forward.
Okay. I'm Dr. Paul Adamus. My address is 6028 Northwest Burgundy Drive in Corvallis. And I'm a wetland scientist. I have been for the last 25 years. I teach college students. I teach other wetland consultants. I teach people in the government agencies which regulate wetlands. And I've spoken on this, well, in addition to teaching, I also do consulting. I've consulted with some of the owners of mitigation banks. I've consulted a lot with private landowners. So I think I've seen a lot of different sides of this issue. I find it interesting because 17 years ago I was invited to the U.S. Congress to present testimony on exactly the same topic of wetlands and wetland regulation. And it is a very important topic, a lot of misconceptions and a lot of different perspectives. This particular House bill I find to be something that needs some serious amendments, and perhaps in the form that it's in right now, I would recommend that it not be sent out of committee. The whole concept of mitigation banking, I think, is a very powerful and a very useful tool in the whole spectrum of tools that are used in wetland regulation. But I don't think that mitigation should be the only tool or the primary tool. There are other things like constructed wetlands, wetland enhancement, wetland restoration. We need a lot of choices as a society as to how we're going to deal with wetlands, because as other people have said, different types of wetlands have different function values. This bill to me seems like it's prescribing a one-size-fits-all kind of approach, that one size being mitigation banking. And, you know, again, I think mitigation banking is good, but this particular bill puts too much in that one box. I think that it's bad science and it's bad policy to put everything into mitigation banking. And I'll go into that in a little bit. And it's potentially wasteful of taxpayers' money. Basically, as my written testimony has laid out, I see possibly seven problems with this as it's currently proposed. I'd like to start out first saying that I think that the regulatory programs, the wetland regulatory programs here at a state level are good programs. They're improving. Yes, there have been problems. And I've dealt with a lot of landowners, so I know that very well. There have been problems. But the vast majority of people who apply to the state for permits to alter wetlands are given approval by the state. And I'm sure Mr. Lilly would have statistics on that, but you know, oftentimes the hang-up seems to be at the federal level, that the Corps of Engineers and EPA, and there's not a lot we can do about that. But Oregonians, on numerous occasions in the past, through legislation here in Salem, have indicated their support for wetlands dating back to the 1980s and 1990s. So, you know, my first point is that if it ain't broke, you know, don't fix it. I don't see that things are that severely broken that we need to do the sort of drastic measures that are proposed as I read it in this bill. The second point I have is the payment rate of $20,000, as other people have mentioned, or 75% of assessed values. Wetlands often have relatively low assessed values, so this is not going to generate enough money, enough revenue, to pay for the replacement, the restoration. I mean, it costs a fair amount of money to hire an engineer to design a constructed wetland and then to go out and build it, go out and monitor it, and so on. And the pay-in rates that are proposed here are just not realistic. Third is this matter that other people have alluded to, the ratio, one-to-one mitigation ratio. A number of national panels, the National Academy of Sciences, the General Accounting Office, have specifically said that that when planning constructed wetlands and wetland mitigation, it's advisable to go more than a one-to-one ratio because of the high risk of failure. And there have been dozens of studies in the scientific journals that have demonstrated that not all of these mitigation projects work. A lot of them fail. They fail in the sense that they don't become wetlands like they were intended to, or they don't provide the functions or whatever. And just like when you design a bridge, you have to build in, you know, failure, risk of failure in your different estimates for maintenance and so on, it has to be the same. And simply a one-to-one ratio is not adequate to address that. Fourth, something, as I read this bill, it seems to be saying that the responsibility and burden for doing wetland delineations and wetland determinations, that responsibility is now going to be solely put on the Division of State Lands. And, you know, my gosh, with the strapped state budgets that we've got right now, I just don't see how, you know, DSL is going to have over, you know, 1,000 permits to process a year. Each one of these delineations takes, you know, up to a day to do in the field. I just don't see where the money is to put so much of the burden on state government to take over this responsibility. Fifth, as I read it, some of the language in the bill seems to line up Oregon with changes in the federal definition or federal jurisdictional definition of wetlands. Specifically, what I am worried about is that this bill could authorize the filling of so-called isolated wetlands. These are wetlands that don't have a surface connection to other navigable waters. The fact is that many of these isolated wetlands are extremely important for wetland functions. You can't say that they're marginal in any sense. They're just as valuable as some of the wetlands that exist along bays and waterways. But I'm not a lawyer, but I'm worried about, you know, if this goes into the courts, how some of this might be interpreted, and that those particular isolated wetlands would not be adequately covered.
Sure. What is the definition of an isolated wetland?
Well, the feds are wrangling over that right now, you know, the lawyers and the scientists and so on. In my sense, what I feel, Representative Girard, is that an isolated wetland is one that, yes, it may lack a surface water connection, and if it also lacks a groundwater connection, then I would consider it to be isolated.
But why is it a wetland?
Okay.
If it doesn't connect to surface water or underground water?
Because sometimes there's natural depressions in the landscape which fill up with snowmelt or rainwater. And they may not be fed by the ground. They may not connect, especially over in eastern Oregon, they don't connect to other waterways. And they would be considered isolated wetlands in some sense.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You know, a sixth reservation that I have in Representative Greenlick, I think this may get at some of the technical questions you mentioned about a lot of small wetlands versus large centralized wetlands. I see problems with unequivocally favoring the use of large centralized wetlands in mitigation banks. There are some advantages for some functions to doing that. Large contiguous wetlands do tend to serve as habitat for larger numbers of ducks, migratory birds, and so on. However, many small wetlands scattered throughout the landscape are very important for some of the water quality functions and for flood storage. A lot of times the very large wetlands are so full up with water, they don't have much space left to store additional water. A lot of these small wetlands do. I would give the particular example of nitrate pollution of groundwater, which is a problem here in several areas of Oregon. Nitrate comes in from fertilizer and other sources. Wetlands are the single most important feature on the entire landscape for filtering nitrogen. That is, the nitrogen comes off in rainwater or as dust from the fertilizer. It goes into the wetland. The wetland then converts that nitrogen. The wetland plants and microbial communities convert that nitrogen into gaseous, you know, the gas form of nitrogen. So it goes from being, you know, soluble in water to a gas. The gas goes off into the air in a harmless form. So these small wetlands, which have a high ratio of shoreline or edge to water, these small wetlands are very important for nitrate assimilation and removing that nitrate before it gets into our drinking water supplies in the ground.
Sir, I'm going to have to ask you to begin to wrap up your testimony.
Okay. I would. On my final point is just the idea of no-net loss. The goal of no-net loss was laid out on a federal level by the first George Bush administration and has been continued through at the state level here, the Oregon benchmarks and legislation. This particular House bill, I'm afraid, would allow local plans to essentially trump local wetland regulation and state wetland regulation here in Oregon. I've been under contract with the community of Corvallis and their Goal 5 planning, and I know that there's not a big issue there. Goal 5 planning and wetlands are being very well integrated, and I see that more and more in other communities. And I want to refute some of the testimony that Mr. Lorenz presented earlier, that when it comes to wetland functions, and this is something I've studied for many years and testified on, when it comes to wetland functions, wetter is not always better. There, for some functions, simply having 2 weeks of inundation, those wetlands are actually better for some functions than the wetlands that are flooded year-round. The converse may be true for other functions. So we have to look at the full suite of functions, and wetter is not always better. So I support the idea of using acreage for determinations of mitigation, but I do feel that functions and values have to be taken into account too. I don't think you should put all your eggs in the functions and values basket. I think you have to have a safety net of mitigation ratios as well.
Would you be available, sir, when we continue this public hearing to come back to answer questions for us?
Yes, I'd be very glad to do
so. We appreciate that very much. Thank you, and we appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And we apologize to Robert Frankel, Mel Stewart, Paul Scholes, and Jim Nass, who are all scheduled to testify this morning, and we did not have the time because of the earlier floor session. But we will, on Thursday, we have arranged to have Nan Evans, who is the new interim director of LCDC, to speak to this committee. And we will intend to pick back up on 2431 just as rapidly as we can after that on Thursday. So with our apologies to those who we invite back on Thursday, and they'll be given top-of-the-list protection for their testimony, we will adjourn this meeting of the House Committee on Environment and Land Use.